you all know me, I'm Eli Shavuot, what is currently the Department of Language and Cultural Asia, and I'm the chair of the Central Asia Studies Program and the Middle East Studies Program. Before I introduce our speaker, I'm just going to make note of several announcements here. There is a film screening in honor of Genocide Awareness Month, Object of Genocide, followed by a discussion with Scott Strauss. On April 23rd, the Krika talk is going to be by Igor Pichnikov of the Institute for World Culture of Moscow State University, Classical Russian Literature and Digital Humanities, so Russian Digital Libraries and Developments. And on April 30th, there will be a presentation by the filmmaker Ron Hessman, and the topic is Interesting Times, Reflections on Russia in Recent Years. So you can find copies of that there, and I'll put these back. So given my voice, I will be brief. It's a great pleasure to welcome Saltanat Dushalieva Chayevas to our lecture series today. I was pleasantly surprised to learn that she has, in addition to a Bachelor of Arts in English Language and Literature from Kyrgyz National University, that she also has degrees from Kyrgyz National Conservatory in piano. I had no idea about that. She has a Master in Social Work from Washington University in St. Louis, and she's expecting to complete this year her Doctor of Philosophy in Social Work at the University of Maryland in Baltimore. And she's, of course, an honorary fellow with Krika. She has worked as a program coordinator for the international development programs funded by USAID, the Asian Development Bank, the European Union, and other international organizations in Kyrgyzstan and elsewhere in Central Asia, concerning issues of land tenure rights, community-based public health, social economic rehabilitation, and empowerment of women. She has extensive experience in coordinating community-based programs and conducting intervention research, managing regional-level public information campaigns, and liaising relations with local governments on behalf of the international development programs. And her presentation today is Help Seeking and Barriers of Domestic Violence, Survivors in Kyrgyzstan, a Grounded Theory Study. So please join me in welcoming Sophia.
Thank you
for
thank you for the introduction, Eli, and just great to see the supportive group. Thank you so much for coming for my lecture. And the title of my presentation is Help Seeking Barriers of Women Survivors of Domestic Violence in Kyrgyzstan, a Grounded Theory Study. So the purpose of this presentation is fourfold. The first is to build a background and rationale for the study. Secondly, is just to provide a theoretical framework and research methods that focus the study's research questions. Third is to explore the experiences of women survivors of abuse to understand help-seeking barriers that influence these experiences. And fourth is to reflect on the implications for interventions and preventions that could be made for social work practice, policy, and research to address the problem. So as part of building the rationale for the study, I thought I'd start by articulating the scope and the magnitude that the women all over the world experience. And there's a growing body of research that shows that, that establishes the widespread occurrence of violence around the world and as a social, health, and human rights problem. A review of more than 50 population-based surveys from 35 countries all over the world showed that between 10 and 69% of women reported being physically abused by an intimate partner at some point in their lives. And so taken as a whole, the studies show that domestic violence is a global phenomenon that affects women in both resource-rich and resource-poor countries alike. For example, in the United States, according to the most recent survey by the CDC's National Center for Injury Prevention and Control, it is estimated one in four out of four women experience some form of physical or psychological abuse during her lifetime. Researchers have also begun to uncover the links between domestic violence and long-term and both immediate health outcomes. And violence has shown to adversely affect women's health, with evidence of increased risk of HIV/AIDS, mortality in a range of mental, reproductive, and physical health outcomes. It has shown to limit the degree to which women are able to work, earn an income, or make independent decisions about their health and their children's education health. as well as shown to decrease decision-making and problem-solving skills and lower perception of self-efficacy and self-esteem. In addition to these debilitating effects on mental, physical, and reproductive health, domestic violence has enormous social economic costs and negative multiplier effects throughout the society. In 2004, the WHO conducted a review of the literature and concluded that interpersonal violence is expensive, that its economic costs are largely borne by the public sector, and that it places disproportionately heavy economic burden on low-income countries. For example, at a global level, rape and domestic violence account for nearly 1 in 5 health years of life lost to women between ages 15 to 44. A study from the United States reported that total cost of domestic violence was more than $8.3 billion, including direct costs of mental and medical services and indirect costs of lost productivity. And a recent report from Kyrgyzstan presents the direct costs, and it concludes that each intimate partner violence case resulting in death costs more than $2,700. So in summary, it's a pervasive problem. But the question is then, what's the society done to address this problem? And the answer to this question could be partially found in the literature that outlines major developments to address the problem throughout, you know, through international conventions, declarations, and women's rights movements. And so I'll briefly address those in the next slides. So in 1979, the United Nations General Assembly adopted the CEDAW Convention, in which 186 countries that adopted the convention were legally bound to protect women's lives and eliminate all the forms of discrimination. Until that point, really, the governments considered that the problem was a private matter, and the convention made it very clear that it is the governmental responsibility to protect women's lives and provide support services for women. In 1993, it adopted the Declaration, which was the first international human rights instrument that explicitly and exclusively addressed the issue. In response to these global efforts, several international research initiatives were launched. And although they certainly helped us understand the global prevalence of violence, they also revealed some challenges that limited comparisons across the studies. The first challenge was that violence was not uniformly defined throughout the societies. The second is that inconsistencies in measurements and characteristics of the study populations made it difficult to compare across the studies. Third, privacy and confidentiality ensured during the service affected the ability to disclose their views. And finally, the comparison of the data of the countries was complicated by ethnic, cultural, and linguistic differences. So together, these challenges provided a fertile ground for building an international research agenda. And it provided a ground to facilitate cross-cultural interpretations of the phenomenon and develop culturally sensitive prevention and intervention programs in a diverse cultural context. So with this in mind, let me now describe the context for the study. Kyrgyzstan is one of the former Soviet Union republics located in the northeastern mountainous region of Central Asia. There are several unique aspects that make the study timely and relevant. First is that very few studies have been conducted on this topic not in social work, in fact, because it's a new profession, and it's only the role of social workers is only emerging because it's been registered at first in Kyrgyz Republic in 1999. And so it's likely the first effort to describe the experiences of women and draw implications for social work practice, policy, and research. Second, in response to international efforts, the government of Kyrgyzstan publicly recognized violence against women is not just a family issue, but a public policy issue, and undertaken several policy and legal initiatives. It ratified the 2000. The CEDAW Convention in 2002, and adopted a law on social and legal protection from domestic violence in 2003. Third, since independence in 1991, The government promoted the development of civil society, which resulted in the proliferation of women's organizations working to improve the conditions of women. However, even though their efforts have been helpful in passing and drafting the law, these organizations have been unable to address the problem at the societal level. And it also revealed a lot of challenges and inconsistencies in implementation of the law. Finally, there is some evidence to suggest that women in Kyrgyzstan are becoming increasingly vulnerable to domestic violence as they bear the brunt of unprecedented social economic upheaval following the collapse of the former Soviet Union, resulting in negative consequences for women. And I just thought I'd put that picture because it sort of clearly showed that gap between the sort of a wishful thinking of becoming this democracy and civil society and market economy and the real situation of women. Because the rising level of poverty and widening urban-rural divide, deterioration of women's access to public services, and resurgence of patriarchal and traditional values resulted in growing prevalence of and new manifestations of domestic violence, such as bride kidnapping, trafficking in persons, and violence against women. So together, these challenges create a compelling rationale for deepening the research violence agenda in Kyrgyzstan. And Human Rights Watch conducted a study and concluded that it's a pervasive form of violence in the society. According to the Demographic and Health Survey conducted in 2012, 23% of all women ages between 15 to 49 have experienced physical violence at least once since age 15, and 13% have experienced physical violence within the past 12 months. One in four ever married women have been victims of physical violence, 4% have experienced sexual violence, and 14% have suffered emotional violence inflicted by their current or most recent husband. More than half of the women indicated that as a result of domestic violence, they suffered persistent health problems and physical injuries, and only 39% sought assistance in response to violence, with anecdotal evidence suggesting that the figures are much higher and that women prefer to stay silent because of the fear of repercussion, fear of jeopardizing of children's future, acceptance of violence in society, and just lack of other options for women. This chart illustrates the prevalence of acceptance of violence, where you could see pretty high acceptance in rural areas, whereby almost half of the women believe that a husband has the right to beat up the woman in any of the above situations, with disagreement or objection to a husband being the most justifiable basis for the abuse. So given the exploratory nature of the study and lack of empirically tested theories explaining domestic violence in Kyrgyzstan, I've elected to use grounded theory developed by Glaser and Strauss. And because in grounded theory you let the theory emerge from the data, it's very difficult, different from the quantitative approach where you seek to test a set of hypotheses that is informed by prior theory and research. This theoretical foundation is used as a means of refining the research questions and informing the study's epistemological perspective rather than having a preconceived idea of what the data is likely to suggest, so which would be antithetical to the qualitative methodology in the first place. So my own understanding has been informed by several theories, but I'll just mention here that I use symbolic interactionism, feminist, and ecological frameworks just as underpinning frameworks useful for Kyrgyz case. So what I did, I interviewed 16 women between ages 20 to 49 who were residing in the shelter of the capital of Kyrgyzstan, whose duration of abuse ranged from anywhere from 2 to 17 years. All of them had children. The women's education ranged from third grade to a bachelor's degree, and their income ranged from approximately $2,000 a month to poverty level. And I use theoretical sampling approach whereby I selected participants based on the likelihood that they're able to enhance the development of concepts in terms of properties and dimensions. And I stopped when the new information was not emerging around the key concepts. I'm not going to go through all of the ethical considerations, but there were a number of them. And you know, it took a lot of upfront work to obtain IRB from university and Ministry of Health of the Kyrgyz Republic. So the data collected from the interviews was digitally recorded, transcribed, and translated into English, and entered into InVivo 10 qualitative software program. Data analysis was done using constant comparative analysis to examine similarities between respondents and contrast situations. And I used OpenXL and theoretical coding techniques to develop themes grounded in the data. So there are several themes that have come out strongly from the interviews with regard to barriers to health seeking. And first, there are themes related to cultural and religious barriers, such as social construction around marriage, cultural beliefs, and status of the daughter-in-law in the Kyrgyz society. Second, there are themes related to legal barriers that have to do with lack of institutional support and lack of recourse within the criminal justice system. And third, there are systemic and more universal financial barriers, such as lack of housing, childcare, and employment. So as you can see from this conceptual model of barriers to health seeking, the first themes is surrounded by the cluster of cultural norms and expectations that create important barriers to health seeking. And as we go on to create further barriers, such as legal and systemic and financial barriers, which I'm going to deconstruct later in this presentation, together, these barriers keep forcing the woman back and prevent anything from changing. So according to the Kyrgyz cultural tradition, if the girl was getting married, she was leaving her birth family forever. And the Kyrgyz proverb, like the girl who is married belongs to somebody else's family, means that the girl leaves her own family sphere and becomes like a property of the other family. And so the girls are not encouraged to seek parental support after marriage. In fact, they're socialized to focus on the matrimonial family and not, you know, really solve problem by themselves. But as a result of this cultural expectation around marriage, the women essentially lose the protection and the linkage to their own families in the course of marriage. And at the very beginning, there are these cultural biases that push against help seeking. And the cultural construct that seemed to be enforced is that birth family doesn't want to take them back, even when they're being abused, because that is somehow shame on the birth family. I think these quotes make this point very clearly, that the woman went back to her birth family after their constant episodes of abuse, and the birth family didn't want to take her back because they had a shame of divorce of the older daughter, and they just didn't want to tolerate having the repeat of that. And so these quotes illustrate how strong this normative is about marriage and how strongly it seemed to cut off a venue for help seeking. Do I have to read through these or no? Okay. I'm sorry. Do I have to read through this? So, okay. Deeply ingrained cultural beliefs and social sanctions played a powerful role in discouraging the women from seeking help. Study respondents provided several explanations as to why they endured the abuse and couldn't leave. And this was evidenced by the proverbs they're using in their stories. And one of the typical one was, good wife, good husband, good deputy, good hon. So the proverb reinforces the cultural notion that the husband's behavior is shaped by the wife, and it is her responsibility to smooth out family disagreements if they arise. And so, if she's not able to manage the situation and avoid being hurt, then she's somehow guilty of not fulfilling her duty as a peacemaker and caretaker of the family. Another common proverb was used, plates and dishes smash and married couples clash. And the assumption underlying this proverb is that family conflict is a natural and inevitable part of marriage. And so if the couple lives together in the same house, therefore it's inevitable and, you know, normal, can't be helped. But also is that if today a woman quarrels, the next day she makes peace, and then the problem is not even worth any attention because it's here today and gone the next day. Respondents provided other proverbs that explained reasons why they stayed and endured the abuse. Don't sweep your litter outside of the house. A woman has to endure. So I was enduring. I was afraid of the people's judgment. I didn't tell my parents because I didn't want to upset them. Most mothers leave this pattern to us. Patience and labor will win everything. You must stay even if you have difficulties. You may die, but stay, but divorce is a shame. This is how things are. So these explanations included the belief that perseverance wins and that the women are supposed to be strong and endure everything. That divorce is shameful and therefore you have to accept your fate once you're married. And family problems are not to be discussed outside of the home because it's considered to be washing your dirty linen in public. Finally, the women were told that it was their responsibility to keep the families intact for the sake of the children. My sister says, he's father of your child, be patient, maybe he will change. And I was afraid of that since I'm the one separating my son from the father. Another very important theme that runs incredibly strong throughout all of the interviews is the status of daughter-in-law in the Kyrgyz family. And what emerges from the interview is that domestic violence is connected with family cultural tradition about family structure, power, and status within the Kyrgyz family. And particularly the wife moving into the husband's family puts her in a very disempowering position whereby she has a very low subordinate status and basically no rights. And so then it's easy to justify that she's not cooking right or behaving well enough or doing housework right. And I think this quote demonstrates this. Another thing that was so culturally embedded was the role of mother-in-law in the Kyrgyz family. And one important pattern that emerged from the interviews is that women don't just, you know, marry and go live with her husband in the nuclear family. They actually live together with the in-laws, and they're a big part of their life. And so this culturally, the husband's family played a significant role that frequently seemed to be supportive of the abuse. I think the following quotes demonstrate this and also show how mother-in-law actively promoted the abuse and apparently took satisfaction from it. Another cultural construct that prevented women from seeking timely help was placed on the cultural value placed on virginity at the time of marriage. So on the one hand, it enabled bride kidnapping because you could claim the woman once she's deflowered. But on the other hand, it created further justification and rationalization for abuse if she was not a virgin. So this conditions the way domestic violence plays out, and particularly the way help seeking plays out. I lived with the guilt that I wasn't a virgin. I thought this was my punishment. I didn't say a word against, I didn't raise my head. I blamed myself. My husband threatened me that he would tell my parents about it, and I was scared and stayed. I was ashamed. Another cultural theme that was cited by the respondents was the importance of bearing a son, because it was it mattered so much for the continuation of family line. And this factor is not only an indication of devaluation of women in the society, but also a pretext and blaming trope for further abuse. As we could see in this case, the woman is being, you know, essentially held responsible and blamed for not having produced the son. The final cultural theme that was reported by women was the use of religion by the partners to justify violence. So the partners believe that a woman is full of sins, or shaitans, or satans, or devil, and therefore she should be beaten from time to time in order to get rid of those sins. And according to this philosophy, the woman had to surrender to her husband, and he had to surrender to God. So I think the following quote explains how the husband beat his wife as a result of his religious beliefs. Another barrier to help seeking revealed in the interviews was legal barrier, had to do with ineffectuality of the legal system and police response to abuse. And respondents most often indicated that they saw justice system as, a logical and external resource for obtaining assistance with their domestic violence situations. But ironically, it emerged as one of the most significant systemic health-seeking barriers, because at best it seemed to be selective and at worst part of the problem. And as this case points out, the system was compared with a soap bubble system, a superficial system that existed for appearance sake. This thing kept coming out in all the interviews, just like one more piece of the puzzle. And they had this difficult case where abuser was a former law enforcement official. And other law enforcement officials essentially protected him through a type of camaraderie, or esprit de corps, whereby the wolf doesn't betray the wolf. And this quote shows the complete impunity for the official, even in the case when the court protection was issued. They described it as a meaningless piece of paper that didn't serve even as a minimal deterrent. Many participants described cases when the police ridiculed the victim and told them to reconcile with their husbands because they won't intervene in a family issue. And the police made fun of the woman who was practically in homicide and freed the husband up in 2 days after the relatives paid the bribe. And reporting the abuser to the police becomes further blaming trope for the abuse and barrier for help seeking for that woman. In general, use of health services such as hospital and outpatient clinics was only mentioned in the context of obtaining medical help. But several women reported that they were referred to the Office of Judicial Medical Expertise. And this case is instructive because it shows the inherent difficulties that the victims face when they want to pursue legal action against the perpetrator with them. Support from the Office of Medical Expertise. In this case, the client described that she was referred to the office and underwent the examination, but she couldn't afford all the tests, and so didn't obtain the certification that was needed to file the charges against her husband. In addition to cultural and legal barriers, there were systemic barriers such as lack of housing and finances and childcare and employment opportunities. And so the most common reason for not leaving a violent home was no viable options for housing and childcare. So one woman, for example, expressed that she didn't want to ask help from her family because she didn't want to be a burden, and it was particularly difficult when the children were involved. They called her insatiable sibling, as you could see, and when is she gonna move on her own feet? So the results of the study indicate that culture of gender inequality and acceptance of gender violence were primary barriers for help seeking, because the woman feared the shame and stigma of divorce, and they believed that such abusive behaviors on the part of the husband and his family was normal and acceptable. And so this supports prior international research that shows that abuse by many women was justified, and that men and his family used it as a legitimate power of control in the family relationship. In addition to cultural barriers, there were systemic and legal barriers also, and the stories really revealed that police wasn't, or formal institutions, they weren't really responsive part of the picture, and they tended to minimize the abuse and or for the appearance sake. Of course, there were more universal barriers, such as lack of housing and childcare, and these barriers just kept forcing the woman and pushing her back and prevented anything from changing. So these narratives are pointing to potential places for social work interventions to be expanded. And one of them could really address those cultural myths. The new messages could be propagated throughout the society about marriage and family. And what seems to be the most important for sensitizing is for the birth family to understand that they have to take the girl back when she's being abused and delegitimizing the abuser. So creating those messages based on equal gender relationships and mainstreaming them to the general public seems to be one of the strategies that social workers could develop to change the culture and attitudes. It's certainly important to train the responders because this research shows that in cultures where there's a high prevalence of acceptance of violence, if the responders adhere to the negative attitudes that condone violence, it could lead us to what researchers call a double victimization. And certainly concrete support in terms of housing and childcare, it's important because it helps the woman make independent decisions about her situation. And for clinical practice, interventions focusing on recovery and dealing with powerlessness and guilt could help her overcome the shame and stigma that she faces when seeking help. Of course, the limitations are inherent for qualitative research because the findings are not generalizable to the population. However, I feel that these limitations are far outweighed by hearing the voices and lived experiences of women in Kyrgyzstan who made the very difficult decision to seek domestic violence shelter services. I have plenty of references, and this is my daughter. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Saltanat Hamid would be very happy to address any of your questions.
There's so many, but I'll just start with one. Has there been a difference since the collapse of communism? Has it reverted back to old behaviors, or has that behavior been continuous even through the communist period?
Sorry, so your question is whether these problems actually have increased since...
Well,
no, I'm sorry.
When the communists, during the Soviet Union era, whether the sense of equality, the message of equality of that system, whether during that time things were different, maybe better for women, and since the collapse, it has reverted back to a more older, traditional way of treating individuals.
And I think that's partially my lived experience because I lived most half of my life, I should say, in the former Soviet Union, and then another half after its collapse. So I would say that women had a lot more social support in terms of the governmental support because the childcare, for example, the housing was subsidized. And you're right, because the Sovietization actually promoted equality. And labor force participation, that women actually could, be independent. However, it could be that because of the sort of open democracy and sort of getting those issues out there, and women's organizations really thriving after independence, that they started talking more about this problem, which then became not just behind the closed doors, but more out in the public, and really raising these issues. I mean, it's actually amazing how sort of throughout my life I used to hear these proverbs the one who beats is the one who loves, and it sort of was also part of the way justifying violence, I think. And so it's fascinating to see how many proverbs they have. I mean, they were using a lot more, and just sort of, you know, presenting the ones that were so typical, you know. And I'm used to hearing them all my life. I mean, it's also so, you know, part of, and you know, of culture that I've, you know, I was raised in. So, yeah.
It's very interesting, something like that. And it must be really challenging work because it's so interpersonal and you have to gain trust. So, I imagine that's one of your challenges. And my question, and I have many too, but to spin off of this gentleman's question, and maybe you nuance the answer you just gave, it seems to be systemic in the culture because of some of these culturally specific barriers that you addressed. But could you track, and I'm thinking of the United States since 2008, where domestic violence among people who lost their jobs or veterans who come back and had low employment or no employment, there was a spike in domestic violence. And so it was something that the states could track. And it was based on income, poverty. And I'm wondering if that's the kind of thing that you could also track with your respondents, that there's maybe peaks and pits based on economic stress.
Absolutely, and I'm glad you asked that's why I put everything in a larger context, because you couldn't possibly talk about domestic violence without sort of looking at the larger picture of what's going on in social economic situation after the collapse of the former Soviet Union. And the women were saying that men were, well, at least the women talked about their husband in terms of not being able to fulfill that breadwinner role. And because of that helplessness, really they used more violence to exert influence on the women. And you're right. I mean, but I think there's still more sort of universal barriers. And I think research does show that in families who are poor, you know, and maybe alcoholic and everything else, those factors actually play into the situation. However, when you talk about those cultural barriers that they're not necessarily part of American mentality, I'm sorry, they don't think about mother-in-law, you know, and virginity and those issues that come into play, I think, you know, the woman just feels trapped. And so, yeah, I mean, I absolutely agree. Those systemic barriers are... Yeah, go ahead, please. Thank you.
So you were talking about the implications of your research, right? And one of them is raising awareness. And you also, you're talking about the cultural component as being extremely important and actually probably the major component, right, that kind of breeds that kind of violence. So do you have any suggestions as to how you would raise awareness about those kind of cultural perceptions that lead to violence against women? I mean, do you have any kind of specific suggestions or advice or strategies even to do that?
Yeah, you're absolutely right. I mean, it's very important to consider the cultural context before you go in and do anything about interventions, right? And so if I arrive there in the community and say, oh, you know, let's go and, you know, talk about domestic violence and let's, you know, teach you guys how to stick up for yourself and everything. I don't think that any woman would arrive at that kind of workshop at all. Or, you know, I think there has to be some kind of context created where the women are actually already, you know, either leadership groups or I'm sure there's some community groups or even, sort of the microcredit groups of women who already do something. And then based on what's already existing, you can build on it and talk about these issues. And certainly not naming them as this sort of very stigmatizing and dangerous to some extent. Because, I mean, if research definitely shows that in WHO study how they jeopardized women by just simply talking to them, doing household service, and then the women got beaten up because the mother-in-law overheard her talking about violence. You know, how can you deal? You know, these are issues that obviously are very sensitive.
Thank you very much for this talk. It overlaps me. many of the studies conducted in Turkey. But my question is a little bit different from focusing on women, as common studies focuses on women. But the other side is the abuser, and maybe men this side. So we saw here women as victims and women versus society, patriarchal society, the kind of family of their husbands. So these two different things. But they justify a reason to be abused. So they accuses society or their family because they were being abused or they abused. And what I see in your presentation, they are trying to escape from, family. So they trapped in the family, in a family, and they wanted to escape, but they couldn't find any shelter in anywhere, especially their families are refusing them. So I don't think the problem will be solved if they escape from those kind of families. The problem will still be in the society. And they are trying to escape from their husbands or their husbands' families, but they are trying to escape from the problem, the society. So do you have any plan to work on the abusive side, abusive families or abusive men? And do you know any tactics that women can use to understand how the violence works in the brain of the abusive side? Mm-hmm. And one more remark is about the statement of Imam. Mm-hmm. So he states that they need to be jealous. Mm-hmm. And as far as I know, sexual jealousy is deadly. Mm-hmm. So are you planning to work religious lyrics or entities to address this problem in Kyrgyzstan?
Thank you. That's very interesting questions. In fact, I was volunteering for the domestic violence shelter for 3 years as I was doing my research. And certainly, a big part of what they do is, first of all, in that setting, my role wasn't to intervene in sort of any of the situation as a researcher, as an instrument. However, I did work with them on the UN Trust Fund grant, where I help them, design a program whereby the women, could have, for example, through sewing courses, through some empowerment programs like gender trainings, through some computer literacy programs, learn the skills too that would help them move towards independence. And some of the programs that they actually do run is better intervention programs as well. They talk to the husbands and they, and it's a very important side, as you mentioned. I mean, obviously that's half of the problem to address, because they clearly need help. All these men who were gamblers, alcoholics, and range of mental problems. I think it's important to address also religious issues and beliefs, and they worked with religious communities and imams to actually, help them also interpret that these are not the correct ideas that they're necessarily giving to, the youth who were, or the men who were attending the congregations. I think in terms of the systemic changes, the culture change, it's very hard because, I think that it requires a lot of careful considerations of how you actually approach that culture change, because first of all, it's been for generations there, and second of all, they use it as a legitimate power and control mechanisms in the family. because it's obviously, you know, beneficial for the men to be that way, you know, to have that power. I don't know if that answers the question, but I mean, I certainly appreciate that.
Actually, it is not my view to see the culture is the causes and that problem, because here we have different culture in the United States, but domestic violence is still going on and has been addressed. So I personally see the problem with individual, and then I would like to see the other side. How they are brainwashed, why they are violent.
Certainly there are psychological aspects to the individual aspects to the problem. I mean, you know, and there are the psychodynamic theory, maybe more sort of explaining that that part. I mean, I think I am saying, though, that, I mean, of course, don't get me wrong, I mean, I'm just presenting sort of the larger picture, but they talked a huge, tremendous, you know, effect on the psychological level of the women, the loss of self-esteem and all these internal barriers that were just also profound. So that I would agree with the individual problems as well.
I don't know how this would factor in, but in listening to your presentation, I thought of a very sad case that I learned about through a friend of ours who works in Tajikistan. The woman was helping her set up microdevelopment, and she was very successful. And our friend could rely on this woman when she left the country to come back to the States to run this business. But a family member, a male family member, was badgering her so incessantly that she ended up committing suicide because the cycle, like the emotional and probably verbal abuse, and who knows if there was physical abuse, was just so overwhelming. But she took her own life. And I'm wondering if there's any way that it might be another form of silent respondent to your study to track the numbers of self-violence and suicide as one of the most extreme in your research.
Absolutely, and I encountered women who were had suicidal thoughts. Several women mentioned that the only reason they really wanted to live in this world was because of their children. And that really inspired them to, you know, to live for the child. And literally, the in vivo quote, you know. And
but that might be another future way of documenting the violence. I'm not sure if it's done currently, like with autopsies or, you know, if there's been a body found and it looks like it's been self-harm, if that's even recorded, because again, that would be probably a source of shame to the family or to the husband. I don't know. I mean, again, it's a kind of silent respondent for you as a researcher of this to raise awareness, but I'm not sure you would probably know, like, how it's documented in the press, if there's obituaries, or if it's something that's discussed in a village as people are preparing for the funeral. I'm not sure.
Yeah, I mean, there was even the sad case when I was there in my parents' neighborhood. The woman was killed by the husband. And then, well, he first killed her and then he killed himself. And of course the two children were left. And I mean, it created such a huge, you know, it was in the press, it was sort of in the community, it was talked to. But I mean, I hate to say it, it just shows the importance of this work, that it's so important to raise awareness about it and you know, really address the problem at the societal level.
So
yeah,
will you
appreciate that.
At the end, when you finish, will you be working with individuals' outreach centers, going back to the centers for residents you were working with, and maybe like envisioning strategies as John Bull was asking about to raise awareness? Because one of the immediate things I can think about, I was in Korea in 1993 when condom use was pretty much still very taboo in Asia, but they had these posters everywhere and they were kind of cartoon-esque condoms. And it was a very playful way of alerting the society how important it is to stay healthy. And then I think after that, there's no problem to have this as a supply, you know, wherever in stores and such. But I'm thinking of a similar kind of campaign, a poster campaign that could be innocent in its visuals, but mm-hmm. still powerful in its message.
Absolutely. I mean, that's my future research.
Yeah,
that's my next steps. All about sort of.
But nothing like this has existed before, and
nothing like
this campaign has existed before.
I mean, I would say my preference would be to sort of start with the youth, for example, and using technology. And in fact, I'm already talking to the School of Social Work about this, how, you know, to sort of replicate one of the best practices in Kyrgyzstan. And yeah, I mean, certainly there's room for so many different intervention programs that I'm only so excited to just explore. Yeah, thank you.
Are there anything like public media campaigns that are promoted by NGOs or ministries?
Yeah,
like
there's
public awareness campaigns,
yeah,
like on television or radio or newspapers or on posters.
Absolutely, there's a 16-day campaign, violence against women, in December, and so you know they all. You know, for example, I was part of the jury that was for the competition that was among the journalists and media to come up with a project that's called like a piece of, you know, peace in the home or something like that. So they, you know, they did a lot of work to, you know, to publicize those. I think they also. I mean, particularly the leader of this organization who I was working with, she was very charismatic. She was out there, you know, in the talk shows and talking about these issues and, you know, public lectures. So it's encouraging to see that.
During the time that Kyrgyzstan had a woman president, mm-hmm. was this an issue that she raised publicly? Is that something that was autobiographical, took an interest in?
Yeah, she took an interest in a number of issues, and violence against women, yeah, has always been in the, you know, in her agenda, and I was part of the organizing committee last year when I was in Kyrgyzstan for her initiative called Compatriots, and, you know, she really emphasized the need to address these issues there, too.
Can I ask one more question? I was wondering, in the case of Kyrgyzstan, because this is a universal, this country has it, one blog I read complains that people complain about violence in the Middle East as though, against women as though it doesn't exist in the United States. So it's a universal, and we all understand that. I'm losing my thread here. What was I going to say? Let me think for a second.
Yeah, go ahead.
Spins off of that as well. You know, the idea of, I don't know, I mean, you see that everywhere. In the United States, as Heather and I are saying, you know, in the Caucasus where I'm from, right? But I think there's a more kind of, I don't know, like a societal issue at work, because at least in the Caucasus, the position is kind of, it's like this perceived societal roles for two genders, right? Men do this, women do that. And of course, nobody condones violence, right? Nobody kind of, you know, thinks that's normal, right? But then there are certain also statements, again, based on these notions of what genders should do or what they should be like. Like women say, oh, the husband must do this, right? Or the husband should be like this. He must provide, he must do these things. Which is the same kind of strategy that is used in these cases when men say, oh, I am a man and that's why I should be able to do this. And you're a woman, that's why you should behave this way. So, I mean, to me, it sounds like it's a very, you know, it's a much broader issue of perceived gender roles, right? As opposed to just simply kind of saying, you know, violence is wrong, and then violence should not be condoned, and so forth. So how, I mean, I guess it's more of a comment too, not a question, right? Because like, I'm kind of baffled as to how you kind of go about this. And that's why I think why it happens everywhere, including in this country, you know? Because there's certain expectations, certain notions of how gender should behave. And I think without getting rid of those notions, there's really no kind of way for us to say, you know, this is wrong because, right? Because it becomes wrong only in the perception of the person and the gender, right? But not like, I mean, is it?
Yeah, no, absolutely. It makes sense because, I mean, the whole, and I hope that that was sort of clear throughout my presentation as well, the whole construction of, you know, what it means to be a woman and the whole construction of female identity and social roles. It's a socially constructed phenomenon, you know, because when you think of the United States, I mean, yes, we sort of think about some kind of drunkard guy who like whips his wife or something, but there's no all these, you know, sort of barriers, right, issues that are in play, you know, at the same time, like all of virginity or, you know, mother-in-law, those are the things that come into play when we're talking about violence in Kyrgyzstan. And so, I mean, I absolutely agree with you. It's a wider societal issue.
I remembered my question, but first, basically it gets down to a question of, is it culturally specific, yet it occurs across many cultures, because in some ways all cultures have something like that. I thought you were trying to say it's not cultural. It's not, so this is an interesting different take where she's saying it's not culture, you're saying it tends to be, it's cultural, and if it's in all cultures, if there were a neuroscientist here, would he say that it's even actually something really, really deep that's evolutionary in terms of us as mammals or primates? I don't know enough about that. So that's how I see this two different ways. What I was going to ask was more about marriage patterns.
Mm-hmm.
That, you know, it seems to be a universal, yet within Kyrgyz society, is there any variation at all in terms of how people got married, what kind of relationship they have? Are these all arranged marriages? Are most Kyrgyz marrying based on love? Is it something else? Does it influence the results at all in terms of who is likely to be a victim and who is likely to be an abuser?
Absolutely, because who actually knows what bride kidnapping is? Bride kidnapping? So I mean, that violence starts right there. I mean, the first day you see the woman who you don't even know, and you like grab her, and like there were six women that were bride kidnapped in this particular study, and so, I mean, the woman, the psychological pressure that she went through was tremendous. When all these women came and put her scarf and set her in them, and it was all violent. And so from day one, you know, it continues. You know, for some families, maybe, you know, they are okay, you know, they don't see it as violent, but for others, I mean, it's just, the result is really very sad. And I mean, if the arranged marriage, which are a lot in Kyrgyzstan, it is also sort of, you know, it's not like you're, like if the parent, let's say, arranged your marriage, there's also a higher chance of, you know, you not having any say in the marriage. And I mean, I think a lot of studies, really international studies, show that as well. When the woman who didn't want to marry the guy, you know, she had to do it because the father and the parents decided for her.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, she had to escape that marriage, after all. And so, I mean, there's only different types of marriages, yeah. I mean, the people who, you know, marry each other based on love, certainly there are, but yeah.
I had a question about the soap bubble system. I was privileged enough to spend some time in Bishkek working at the embassy, and I know that, well, the whole legal police system, I think, could be construed as a soap bubble system in many people's, I guess, view. But I also know that they receive a lot of money, equipment, training from various countries or international organizations. Is there anything, any strings, I guess, to that money or those donations, I guess, for, I guess, as motivation to take this problem more seriously as far as tracking or enforcement of domestic violence?
It's a good question, because, you know, we just were talking with USAID that shelter, if you could apply for some funding to train the policemen. Because let's face it, I mean, they need to be sensitized to the problem to understand the dynamic in the first place. And, you know, really, you know, just include others, you know, when these cases are brought to their attention, right? I mean, they need to talk to domestic violence counselors and others to understand what the problem is, because you could see the reaction, the response was not responsive. And so I think, it's a fascinating quote. I feel like the soap bubble system is what it's showing, the ineffectuality of, you know, really the lack of response. Thank you.
One question. You focus on your research here on domestic violence in the married women, but I know some women are exposed by violence or abuse by their fathers or family members, and their older brothers maybe, or younger brothers. Do you have any numbers about that?
Well, yeah, absolutely. The women were totally telling stories about how the brother-in-law beat her, you know, the sisters-in-law beat her.
Their own family.
Do they ever experience it from their own family, not the family of the husband?
Oh, okay, you mean before joining the husband's family? Yeah, there were definitely cases where the women were saying, in fact, one woman is saying, I am in the third generation of violence. I've always used to see how my grandfather used to beat and chase my grandmother with his son. You know, hammer, whatever it's called. And then, you know, I was always used to see violence in my own family where my mom and dad used to fight. And to tell you the truth, she said, I didn't even know where better off am I going to be, in this violent home or out of violent home. So, you know, this was the truth that, in fact, does, you know, talks to the intergenerational aspect and systemic sort of aspect of violence. That it really is also a social learning behavior and role model by, you know, our society, by our families. And in fact, I come from the family where, you know, my cousins in rural areas used to do the black kidnapping and beat up their wives. And this is my lived experience, you know, pretty much, in terms of what the exposure is. And I think this has to change. I mean, we've come a long way as well. I mean, it's definitely hard. And I mean, I think sort of as a researcher, I felt always an awkward in this situation because here I am, you know, this feminist domestic violence worker who's trying to change this and talk about this. And when I'm like in the family right there, pushed into this restrictive gender roles where I have to sort of, you know, and I was clearly indicated not to raise this issue, so I was, you know, it was really hard for me as well. So, thank you.
One of the things that I find fascinating is it's something similar to black-on-black violence. I mean, I can understand maybe the moment, you know, it's an ancient cross-societal men beating men, another extension of that, and that's one of the questions I have for the two, is male-on-male violence. But one of the things I find really fascinating is how women who have gone through all this themselves then end up incorporating it into their
I mean, I absolutely agree with you. It is fascinating.
It is fascinating.
Because to me, even watching sort of the dynamic of the Kyrgyz families is a whole other ethnographic study, because, I mean, you know, just to sort of see how the mothers-in-law, they institutionalize those relationships between daughters-in-law. And in fact, when they become mother-in-law, that's what sort of incentivizes also as well for them to be in that role. You know, because they know it'll pay me back, because, you know, I will be in that role, and I'll have absolute obedience of my daughter-in-law.
Mm-hmm.
And so, well, the man-to-man violence is absolute. It's obviously an issue of power and control, not so much about physical power. I mean, it is about, you know, yeah, I mean, we've read the research about same-sex violence, and I mean, it's obviously also very issue of the power and control, and not just about sort of gender or.
One last thing, as we know, Hillary Clinton just announced that she's running for president, and one of the things I was sort of bothered me about her and Madeleine Albright is they sort of put women's issues ahead of maybe other pragmatic policy issues in terms of Afghanistan. You're doing work which could be viewed as being imposed on the society by Western European values, you know, foreign ideas. So I worry about people in your situation who are going into a society that maybe is not eager to embrace these values. I also worry about if Hillary Clinton becomes president, whether she is going to once again put these things to the fore, which could have some fairly serious foreign policy repercussions.
I totally respect Hillary Clinton for raising these issues of violence and putting them up on the forefront of the agenda. Because she has been to all of those countries, and she knows exactly what she's talking about. When the women are being from very little age, what's the term for the mutilation? Exactly. And when the women are, you know, they don't have any access to resources, and you know, their situation is really very vulnerable. So I think that you know, I totally think that it's, you know, she makes very powerful statements about these. And in terms of me doing this research, I think as an insider, you know, if I was an outsider, let's say some kind of an American, you know, Western type researcher, then I would definitely have had a problem. But because I know the language, and I am, you know, connected to the community, and I know sort of and have the sort of access to the population and people there, I don't see that as a, you know, as them seeing me as threatening. I mean, I don't know, I've never experienced any sort of from that position. And of course, you have to be careful. That said, any researcher in this kind of doing this kind of research has to be taking care of themselves and the victims. It's most important to do every precaution not to put her at risk more than she's already is. And there are certainly guidelines, WHO guidelines of how to do it. They've written so much about this because they've done so much research and experienced all these things in the field. So it's certainly a very good point.
Is there a role for television in behavior modification? In television programming, in shows that people see that shift societal values like they ask here?
I would say very little. In fact, one woman, you know, when she talked about, she said, it's a taboo topic. I've never seen a television program that talks about this issue, so they need more of those. And I think that's where the changes come. you know, is going to come from, you know, from really raising these issues and, you know, in the media, in the public, and as I mentioned.
One of the themes in Chinggis Aitmatov's works is to include, I mean, one of them is violence against women, so it's kind of embedded even in classics of Kyrgyz literature. But we can try to wrap up. If, does anybody have a final question? And if not, I'll permit myself one last question. We'll have a chance. So, I really, going back to your first question, I think of probably, you have, as we know from Aitmatov's works, and we know from, you know, that violence against women existed, and, you know, you asked about the Soviet times as though it was a utopian society, almost. And, you know, in my understanding, stereotypes of gender roles in the Soviet Union, that, you know, women, even though there were certain social supports like nurseries and so on, that women were given the larger share, the vastly larger share of taking care of the family and so on. So I think, you know, it really would be interesting to think about this in a historical time too, like how far, going how far back and so on. Can you talk about, you know, violence against women and so on? But I was wondering, in terms of, you know, kidnapping and so on, do you have evidence for this at the earlier Soviet times or the 19th century? Because sometimes I think this is like a Soviet era phenomenon. From the Caucasus, just like all this Kamagan and all this toasting, this kind of cross-cultural transmission of phenomena in the Soviet period. So can we talk about pride, kidnapping, for example, in Kyrgyz culture in the early 20th century or the 19th century? Or do you have anecdotes about this from your grandparents or great-grandparents, or not really?
In fact, I don't, and that actually tells me that your point may be correct in terms of that more becoming ever widespread, you know, in, during Soviet times. And really what spearheaded is the practical reason of not, you know, having all these costs of, you know, the very elaborate weddings where they have to exchange all these very, you know, gifts. So really the men just, you know, and so this was actually more by agreement, you know, done to avoid those costs, but then it was then developed into something that was completely different, you know. So there's one study that I know of, Russell Kleinbach, who was a researcher at UCA, and, I mean, that study is very new, and it's after the collapse of the Soviet Union, not during, and so he's done the survey basically that found that 60% of women in the area that he did the survey were by kidnapped. And I mean, there were all these movies, I don't know if you've seen those, about bride kidnapping, but I mean, I find them unethical because basically it was following those around and, you know, videotaping those. But I mean, it's certainly the issues that is, I mean, very, very prevalent.
This has been a great discussion, so thank you, and thanks for listening.
Thank you for facilitating.
Are you going to take care of closing?
Oh my gosh.
Yeah.
Awesome. When are you, I know you're not supposed to ask this question, but when do you think you'll be defending? This summer.
Oh. Great.
Tomorrow's school? Probably, the weather's tomorrow's Friday. Probably. Okay, cool. Okay. I'll send you a text or email just to confirm. Okay. Yeah, that'd be great. We'll stop by your house. Okay. See
you. Thank you.
Thank you so much.
See you. Yes. 2011. So in the Austin Military Corporation. I'm getting my master's. Yes. Hopefully. Well, I don't know. They just changed our region. Central Asia is not part of the European area region, farm area, Austria. So, I don't know. But it's been, I worked as the Caribbean First Officer in the U.S. Army Central for the last right in here. So, lots of trips back and forth. Yes. You know, it seems that the most important foreign policy decision in the United States in Kyrgyzstan is how they're treating the